Okay, everybody, we might start. I'm going to try and be prompt. Having said that, my name is Kate Rogers. I'm Acting Chief Economist Development at the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. This session, one of our speakers has dropped out, so we've got the potential to be the first people to lunch. So we won't keep you trapped in here for 90 minutes. We will actually cut it back to accommodate the fact that we have two speakers rather than three, just for those of you who like to keep track of these things. We'll just wait for these last people to come in. That's down here. That's okay. Yeah. Yep. We're very accommodating of people. Burst of people. What's going to happen again? Something happened out there. They started taking away the morning tea. Okay, so the title of this session is AIDS Changing Landscape. Of course, there are many elements to this, and I thought before we launched into the session, I might throw out some of the other elements of the changing landscape. I think it's a very timely session because I think certainly in my 20-odd years working in development, I've not actually seen a moment of this much flux and this much change in the aid landscape. And, of course, everyone says that at every moment that they're in, so you can decide whether or not you agree with me on that. But I guess some of the other elements in relation to the changing landscape that I see at the moment are the increasing of private sector engagement in the aid landscape. I'm not just talking about contracting. Contracting of aid projects has always been there. But I think because of the massive changes in the global economy, particularly since 2008, there's been a much greater focus on private sector engagement in different ways. So the most obvious example is, of course, this idea of public-private partnerships in relation to infrastructure and other sorts of arrangements like that. So much greater focus on those sorts of things. Of course, we've also got the enormous impact of technology, meaning that people can actually give direct now, and in fact that's the name of one of the organisations that you can do it through. Now, those of us who've studied development for a long time will understand that that actually removes, you know, one of the major criticisms around development aid, and that is the principal agent issue. You know, you taking out all the middlemen, going direct is a transformational kind of change, I think, in the aid landscape. It's been commented on for some time that there's been a rise in philanthropic engagement in the aid sector. And also we're seeing a lot more discussion around social impact investment. And I know from conversations that we've had in DFAT, you know, there is that sense that, you know, there is an appetite to be engaged in this area. There's an issue with bankable projects and finding the right sort of projects to meet the needs of investors. And finally, I guess I would say there is that issue of the decreasing relevance of traditional donors in the architecture. And that leads us, segues neatly into the topic of this session, which is South-South cooperation. I think it's an incredibly interesting topic, and particularly in our region, but perhaps I'd say that if I was in any region of the world where there is a lot of development. Why is it so interesting to me? Well, it's interesting to me because it's always a bit of a mystery. We can't really quantify it, so we don't know how big it is. I saw one estimate this morning when I was doing my last-minute preparations for chairing this panel, that there are some estimates that China's aid program could be anywhere between $1.5 billion and $25 billion US dollars. You know, how do you deal with numbers that are that massive in variation? So we simply just don't have a great handle on how big these flows are. And I guess the other thing that we don't have a... Do you want to come around here? The other thing that we don't have a great handle on is what this aid looks like. Now, for those of us who are from the traditional donor community, of course, you know, we've operated by and large through the DAC, the Development Assistance Committee. They set the rules, we report to them against particular codes and sectors, and they keep track of all of that for us. Now, many of the South-South donors don't necessarily agree with the principles that the DAC has set. So in a sense, it's not just an issue of quantifying aid, it's also a question of actually identifying whether it is aid. And I think that makes this whole section and this whole topic very interesting as well. So I'll leave it there, but let's introduce the panellist. Very distracting, extremely cute baby down the front. Looking right at me. I won't pull faces, although I don't think we're being filmed. Okay, so today we have two panellists. Each panellist will speak for 15 to 20 minutes. We'll have both the panellists speak and then we'll take questions at the end. Our first panellist is Anthea Mulakala from the Asia Foundation. And Anthea is going to present on the rise of the South and the transformation of development cooperation in the 21st century.
Good morning, everyone. This paper is a result of a project that the Asia Foundation runs on Asian approaches to development cooperation. So I wrote it together with Swarnam Wangle, who is in the National Planning Commission of Nepal. He's not here today, so I'm presenting the paper, and it'll be forthcoming in a publication produced by KDI Press that'll come out later this year. So the paper argues that the growth and development of southern countries, particularly those from Asia, has really changed the global balance of power and contributed to the expansion of South-South cooperation. And as a result, a phenomena that was once under the radar of traditional or Western donors has now become more visible, crossing paths, converging, colliding even with traditional forms of aid. And new forms of South-South cooperation continue to transform the narrative and practice of development cooperation. So up until the 21st century, traditional aid and South-South cooperation rarely crossed paths. Few observers or stakeholders compared or contrasted them because they shared so few similarities. Most analysts and academics agree that up until the turn of the century, until 2000, traditional aid and South-South cooperation had acquired distinct principles, architecture, and modalities. And in particular, we can see different roles that were played by the state. The impact of the aid recipient experience was different, and there are distinctions in conditionality and monitoring, and also in the very definition of development cooperation. I'll just have you look at those. I won't go through them. We're probably mostly quite familiar with some of these, I think. So in the last decade, southern and Asian countries have increased their global might and influence, economically, politically, socially, and this is transforming the nature of aid and development cooperation. These are just some of the changes that we summarize in the chapter. So in 1820, Asian countries produced over 56% of world output, overwhelmingly accounted for by China and India, but excluding Japan. By 1950, this share of China and India had fallen to less than 9%. So in the larger sweep of history, this aberration has begun a course correction in the 21st century. And it was during this period of aberration, one with a rich North and a poor South, that the international architecture of foreign aid took shape. So in the 21st century, what we'll see is a profound structural shift in the center of economic gravity. Already, China and India account for at least one quarter of global output, while developing countries combined account for the majority. Among 143 countries, 142 improved their Human Development Index between 1990 and 2014. China has the most remarkable ascent, having pulled 700 million people out of poverty between 1981 and 2008. We also see the expansion of the middle class. So by 2030, barring an unforeseen global shock or a downturn over the next decade, more than 80% of the world's middle class will live in the megacities of the South. They will account for 70% of total consumption expenditure. And also this will concentrate the greatest body of knowledge about large-scale development concerns in the southern countries that house these megacities. Southern models of trade, investment, and technology transfer have also found ready application at home and abroad. In 2014, more FDI went to developing countries than developed countries, and the former have now become the source of about one-third of outgoing FDI. So this slide basically shows how ODA has declined in terms of its share of development finance in the Asia Pacific. So in 1990, ODA was the largest resource flow to 27 countries in the region, but by 2011 had fallen to only 9 countries, 6 of which are LDCs. And remittances are the largest flow to 12 countries. Official development assistance grew by more than a third over the period from $31 billion U.S. in 1990 to $42 billion in 2012. However, the rapid growth in other resources means that ODA accounts for a declining proportion of the overall development finance envelope for countries. Kate mentioned China earlier. So here we can see China's growth as compared to DAC donors. So if you compare China on kind of DAC-like terms, as Kate mentioned also, it's hard to measure, China would rank 6th. With a portfolio of about $7.1 billion. And it's estimated Chinese foreign aid as a proxy of OECD DAC-defined ODA. And China's development model, development cooperation model, was largely based on Japan's, as was Korea's. And we see that Asian development models figure prominently in the rise of the South. Perhaps the most significant feature of the rise of the South may be its impact on aid and development cooperation. In Asia, Chinese, Indian, and Korean South-South cooperation activities have expanded in proportion to their national economies. They now include trade and investment, diplomatic and strategic support, and also efforts resembling and occupying a similar space to traditional Western aid. Since the days of the non-aligned movement, you see more heterogeneity has developed within the South. Cooperation approaches differ, and economic partnership rather than political solidarity underpins more South-South cooperation relationships. There's a small group, notably China and India, which have emerged as superpowers in the region, with the resources and capabilities both to invest significantly and offer aid-like support in their partner countries. South Korea and Japan, as Asian middle powers, present a unique Asian approach to an Asian DAC model, shall we say, sharing features with South-South cooperation so that they promote their national models of development, are in favor of mutual benefit, and have some tied aid, but they also share features with the DAC. And there are other emerging economies in Asia, including Indonesia. Miranda will present in more detail on that later. Thailand and Mongolia, they also have developed cooperation programs, which include features both from South-South cooperation and traditional aid. The contemporary architecture for aid and South-South cooperation demonstrates both convergence between the North and the South at national levels and a divergence at international levels. And there are 4 notable trends. As their South-South cooperation or Asian development cooperation grows, provider countries find it increasingly difficult to sustain the fragmented, multi-pronged management structures of their cooperation programs. And so in response, you see that several Asian countries have begun to develop their own discrete institutional architecture for South-South cooperation. So India, Korea, Thailand, Indonesia have or are moving towards dedicated aid agencies to manage their aid. And the value of these institutions lies in their ability to consolidate their development initiatives. However, the risk lies in their becoming rigid bureaucracies that may stifle flexible, fast, and situationally responsive nature of South-South cooperation that has long made it effective. So in this connection, we also might note that Canada, Australia, New Zealand, all DAC members have collapsed their once distinct aid departments within their ministries of foreign affairs and trade. And this reflects, you know, closer ties between aid and foreign policy. And it also provides some learning from the example of South-South Corporation providers. A second development is the growth of Southern scholarship on South-South Corporation. So development studies are no longer the sole province of Western analysts. And you have organizations, there's a lot of acronyms there, but Korea Development Institute, Research Information Systems for Developing Countries in India, you have the Network for International Development Cooperation in Thailand, DRC in China, our own network in the Asia Foundation called Asian Approaches to Development Cooperation, and you have the network of Southern think tanks. And these institutions have both shaped and shared knowledge in vital ways to the evolution of South-South cooperation discourse. And third, as a counter proposal to the Global Partnership for Development Cooperation, India has convened twice, in April 2013 and also in 2016, the first self-supported dialogues on development cooperation amongst the South. And this is known as the Delhi Process, as it has been named, and it establishes a separate institutional platform for the South to pursue dialogue and share experience. And finally, the two new Southern-led multilateral banks, the New Development Bank and the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, provide an opportunity for Southern providers to set new norms and a new vision for development cooperation. Infrastructure clearly has been a priority for Southern providers, and the ADB estimates that Asia alone requires $1 trillion annually to meet its infrastructure needs. Only a few years ago, a least developed country without the credit capacity to borrow in the international capital markets had no option but to go to a global financial institution such as the World Bank or to a regional multilateral bank for large-scale financing. Since the 2000s, China, India, and Brazil, but also other southern-based institutions, have emerged as a major source of concessional and commercial development financing in Africa and Asia. And the line of credit has become India's fastest-growing cooperation instrument. So in 2014-15, India's lines of credit totaled more than U.S. $40 billion across 66 countries. The majority are going to Africa and in the energy and transport sectors. And the formal establishment of the AIIB and the NDP increased the range of financing opportunities for developing countries, especially for infrastructure development. And such Southern-led initiatives represent a significant shift in the development emphasis and resources from governance and social sectors, which have been favored by traditional donors, to priorities that are much more demanded by the South. We also see an expanding role for NGOs and the private sector in South-South cooperation. So for decades, NGOs have served as principal partners in implementing traditional development assistance, but historically they have not had a significant presence in South-South cooperation. In the 21st century, however, Asian NGOs have become more involved in development and South-South cooperation, including development policy. And this expanding space for civil society, though it is still constrained, represents a significant shift from conventional state-led models of development and development cooperation. It also opens up channels for convergence and dialogue between northern and southern civil society. Asian private sector is also playing an important and expanding role, particularly in investment, lines of credit, export credits, but also in CSR and shared value. And the Asia Foundation has convened a series of dialogues last year in 2016 on the role of NGOs and the private sector for development, their engagement in development. We'll have a plenary this afternoon that actually looks at the Asian and Australian private sector engagement in South-South cooperation. It'll speak well to the points made by the minister this morning. And just a couple of facts up here. There are actually 516 Chinese NGOs that operate outside China, so they're doing development programming. And that's a little known fact. And Chinese government's policy right now is very supportive of diverse types of partnerships, so very much supporting the work of NGOs and private sector overseas. Transparency and accountability. In recent years, the more prominent engagement of civil society has contributed to greater transparency and accountability amongst Asian South-South cooperation providers. South Korea, India, and China have increasingly vocal domestic constituencies demanding justification of foreign assistance transfers in the face of persistent domestic needs. China produced, in response, China has produced two white papers and has new Ministry of Finance statistical guidelines for foreign aid, which were reduced in 2015. India also last year, 2015-16, introduced new guidelines for their lines of credit. China also has new regulations for competition for investment overseas as well. And the new multilateral initiatives such as the AIIB and the NDB have committed themselves to transparency and openness. So there isn't as much sort of cloud around some South-South cooperation initiatives as we may think. There's increasing transparency. In the past, Asian providers followed a strict demand-driven principle and did not concern themselves with impacts, outcomes, or value for money. Most South-South cooperation providers also reject the complex and expensive monitoring and evaluation frameworks associated with traditional aid. However, you do see some change here. And one of the latest developments is by the Network of Southern Think Tanks. And it's today, government officials and academics in India, China, Korea, Thailand have all embarked on assessment exercises, developing their own evaluation frameworks to better understand the impact of South-South cooperation efforts. And NEST has been working for 2 years to develop a monitoring and evaluation framework for SSC. And these bilateral and multilateral efforts are moving towards establishing a unique Southern approach to benchmarking South-South cooperation effectiveness. So this is a brand new framework. It came out last November, I think, from the Network of Southern Think Tanks. It hasn't yet been tested, but a number of countries, South-South cooperation providers, are looking to start testing it. And it's a little bit in contrast to the traditional framework that the DAC NGO, that the DAC donors use. South-South cooperation has also prompted an evolution in both Western aid discourse and South-South cooperation's narrative, a process that signals elements of convergence and also areas of contested meaning. First, the traditional aid narrative has become less hierarchical and more inclusive on all sides. Traditional aid has historically been presented primarily as altruistic and philanthropic in nature. I think the minister said something about that morning, that that's the old-fashioned way of looking at aid. And she's correct. In the last two decades, traditional donors have acknowledged the element of self-interest or national interest in their aid schemes and have aligned their aid much more closely with economic objectives. The West no longer views aid and trade as discrete domains, but as part of a single fabric of bilateral cooperation, increasingly mutual benefit, which has long been a key principle of South-South cooperation, has become accepted as a core principle of development partnerships. Second, South-South cooperation has also struggled to find its own contemporary narrative. And although the political solidarity of the non-aligned movement days has given way to increasing economic interests, the principles of mutual benefit, non-conditionality, non-interference in domestic affairs, and demand-driven partnerships remain fundamental to South-South cooperation. But traditional aid language has also crept into the discourse. So you will see China sometimes referring to its South-South cooperation as foreign aid. Their white paper is the white paper on Chinese foreign aid. So there is a little bit of overlap in language. So the philosophy still remains quite distinct. So the growing diversity of the South, along with the absence of a contemporary unifying platform for Southern actors, has on the one hand inhibited the evolution of a single South-South cooperation narrative, while on the other it questions whether a single narrative is realistic or desirable. And again, India has emerged as a significant shaper of the multilateral discourse around this. And NEST and the embryonic Delhi process I mentioned earlier may provide possible platforms. So from global trade rules and national fiscal policies to shifting demographics and the consequences of climate change, no common agenda will advance without the consent and contribution of the South. We see this in the Paris Accord as well as G20 and the more inclusive models that are coming out of the traditional multilateral financial institutions. And the SDGs also offer a shared agenda. However, aid commitments for the North remain necessary, and this is heavily stressed by South-South cooperation providers. The contemporary aid discourse holds that the global challenges facing the 21st century must look beyond aid for solutions, and some, but not all of these, will lie in South-South cooperation. So just to summarize, with the rise of the South, and Asia in particular, the world is circling back to a world beyond aid, where there are many sources of finance and cooperation that contribute to development. And what this has done is open up new space for partnerships, innovative partnerships in particular. And Asian countries are leading the way, defining both the strategies and discourse of cooperation in the 21st century. That's my last slide. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. That was a fabulous presentation and raised lots of questions for me. I won't take up all the time, though, when we actually get to the questions section. But, you know, there's the interaction of the rise in a South-South cooperation and the changing polarity in economic power is it's just a fascinating issue. Okay, we're going to go from the macro to the... You can't call Indonesia really micro, can you? But to the micro in terms of the topic. Our next speaker is Miranda Tahali. Sorry, I've just said that incorrectly. Apologies. Miranda is a PhD student here at the ANU in the School of Anthropology and Archaeology. So Miranda will be speaking on Nurturing the Neighbour, Indonesian Development Cooperation to Myanmar.
Thank you, everyone. I think Andrea has given a very remarkable concept about South-South, and maybe now I'm looking more narrow about the Indonesian case, which she also mentioned. But this research is coming from as part of my PhD, looking specifically on the relation of South-South cooperation between Indonesia and Myanmar over the past years. I'm conducting interview with a government official in both countries, NGO, donor partner, as well as the private sector of Indonesia who works in Myanmar. To begin with, maybe I want to identify what is actually Indonesian South-South cooperation. As we know, Indonesian South-South cooperation has been rooted from the Bandung Conference back in 1955. And the commitment of government to reshape what is called the South-South cooperation is enacted within the Jakarta Commitment published in the 2009. In the recent government, the Jokowi government, as we see, he really liked the narrative of bringing up the old kind of a way of, you know, the Sukarno era, what is the spirit of the Bandung Conference, within his foreign policy narrative. It identified during his speech in the Asian African Commencement back in 2015, as well as how it mentioned during the Islamic Country Conference back in 2016. So this kind of a way of narrative of solidarity, non-intervention, mutual benefit, win-win solution has always been there. Bringing up that background of Indonesia, I want to also see what is actually the concept that become the background of my research. As the UN South-South Cooperation Office identified that South-South Cooperation is a collaboration among countries in the South within the political, economic, social, cultural, and environment. And also, other identified that if you want to look at South-South, you have to see, you have to understand the force behind the idea, the history, as well as the the nature that come within the international political and how it narrated within the global system. So looking at this, I want to specifically look at what is actually Indonesia implementation of South in Myanmar. Indonesia and Myanmar have a long history of cooperation since back in the 1950s. As we know, Burma at that time, or Myanmar, was the first country that acknowledged Indonesian independence. And then both countries also play an important role in the Bandung Conference in 1955. Looking at the long history, when Myanmar has a problem with its military regime and the economic embargo from the 1980s to 2000, I think Indonesia also play its important role within the bilateral cooperation as well as also within the ASEAN. That's not just Indonesia at that time, maybe also all the ASEAN countries, Singapore, Malaysia, including China, maybe India at that time, except all the Western part who's putting up because of the embargo. Specifically looking at the cooperation, when I asked the government of Myanmar about what is the foundation of the current cooperation, they also refer it to these three MOUs that they signed. One is the trade agreement, and then also there's a capacity building support that the government, both government agreed. In 2016, also based on my observation during this Ministry of Foreign Affairs meeting on how identifying the targeted countries, it's also mentioned clearly that Myanmar is Indonesian that targeted country for their sort of cooperation. Besides other countries in their framework, so I guess this long history has been coming. So what is actually that the government done at the recent years? So I can divide it the scope of cooperation within these three contexts. The first is political cooperation. I think the why I say political because this is very much as they mentioned is bilateral cooperation that come from the interest or the interest of the government in supporting, especially in the case of Rohingya. Media has put a lot of pressure to the government to do something on this kind of a case, and this has been translated into their foreign policy by supporting Myanmar. Indonesia has built, for example, 6 schools since 2014, specifically in Rakhine State, because it's in a Rohingya kind of a case. And it also already acknowledged and put in their data system in support as within the $1 million in 2016. The second kind of a component that I want to see is that Indonesia also gave is the technical cooperation. This is what I mentioned is about the G2G capacity building training program. I probably have to refer to the first one. This budget is only coming from the national budget. So this is Indonesian budget to the Myanmar. For the second one, it's a mix between the South-South, pure South-South, as well as the triangular. So there's also an involvement of the traditional genre in training, because most of the training are also conducted within the bigger triangular cooperation program. And it has been identified from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, that from since 1999 to 2016, there are 70 programs that has been implemented, and including 232 people participated. Myanmar is participated in this program within the scope of area of health, education, good governance, and so on. And the third part is the trade cooperation. When I asked the government of Myanmar about the source of cooperation with Indonesia, what they highlight is about this trade cooperation, because they have a trade agreement that identify about the possibility of Indonesia work the trade to work in Myanmar, but at the same time they also criticize because of part of the agreement, which including the capacity building to support this kind of a mechanism, hasn't been implemented for so long. So this kind of a thing, I can probably want to capture it at mapping up what is actually Indonesian South-South cooperation and why it never been have a big sense of it in the other area. As we see, probably if we see the definition of South-South is mixed between economic cooperation and aid. While on the other hand, for Indonesia, what I can see, the political cooperation is identified as a bilateral cooperation. They don't want to put it as a South-South cooperation. They clearly identify this is bilateral Indonesia cooperation. That coming from our national budget, we don't mean to support Myanmar's government. And the second one is the technical cooperation. In Indonesia, they have what they call it National Coordination Team on South-South Cooperation. This is the scope of the work of what they are doing. The first part is the scope of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, because this is very political. The second part, the technical, is the NCT, or National Coordination Team, which consists of Ministry of Planning, Ministry of Finance, State Secretary, and Ministry of Foreign Affairs as well, that implement the project by the related ministry, like Education Ministry or Agriculture Ministry, and so on. And the third part is also the economic part, which also separated. During my interview with the private sector, they say that what we do in Myanmar is purely our own. There's no assistance from the government or whatsoever. Even though the government, for example, the current government always push to do the what they call it economic diplomacy, but still there's still difficulty to link. And most of them are just working. Because they compare it with Vietnam, they compare it with Thailand, they say that the government involved in the process. But for Indonesia, there are still difficulty on matching up the link and the process itself. So that's why even though in the narrative of South-South cooperation, when you talk with the national coordination team, they will identify that it is also important to provide technical cooperation that link with the trade, but it's in the reality, the work doesn't really match that way. So bringing on this kind of an issue, probably I can analyze what was going on in Indonesia, is that they really perceive about the history of South-South cooperation itself. Because it's rooted from the Bandung Conference, and it always narrated within all those three kind of a cooperation. It always identified within their foreign policy, bilateral cooperation, that we have to do because this is part of our solidarity, non-intervention, mutual benefit, and so on. And it's not coming just in that kind of in specific kind of a cooperation. The second one is about the institutional setting. As we see, everything is super so scattered. There's no unifying, which make it so difficult the cooperation to be sound and known, maybe, or you know, identify effectively. Because as we see the history, they already started back from the 90s, maybe, but up until now, the progress is very, very little. Including the monitoring that the government produces is only for the technical cooperation, not for the bilateral or the other. And the third one is about the motivational. When you talk with the government official, Myanmar's government, about what do you think about Indonesia, and they say you have a lot of opportunity because as we have to pick someone between the southern donor or the northern donor. Obviously, we have a strong connection with the southern donor. Why? Because they have been here since a long time ago. We have a very strong historical process. They've been there since when we have a difficulty in our countries, and then also we have a very cultural bond that make it easier. And another part that I will call probably knowledgeable motivation is that we know what their motive are working in our countries, and it's still difficult for us to see what is actually the motive of northern donors coming, because the northern just coming back only since 2011, maybe, because after the transitional government opened the public. But we know how what China want. We know what China want behind the aid that given. So it's that's why the southern has more, I guess, more opportunity to expand. However, I think Indonesia still need to work on it. There's at least two things that I can see within the policy narrative that coming up. Is the first is about the history of it. They're very proud of the history of South-South, and it's also always embedded within all the cooperation that coming up. However, and the second one is the understanding about South-South is not uniform. I don't know whether it need to be uniform or it has to be keep it like that. But because this is still an ongoing research, I will also seek your input on this kind of things. So, to conclude my presentation, I can see that there's at least two layers of what is an Indonesian development conference. The first is about the identity itself, and the second is about the institution and how it works in the field, which is totally different thing. I think the narrative and the identities will still be there, but the thing that need to be revised or need to be structured, I guess, is the institution. And I think with the opportunity that we have long in history of cooperation, I guess they have a lot of opportunity to expand the cooperation even more. I think that's all. Thank you.